Accession number 21095, Reel 9.
Aftermath of the war, I really felt I decided that there was no need to point to these discrepancies in my biography of him or to write about it, because I think all of that was so hugely outweighed by the impact that he made and by the significance and importance of what he has achieved. And I felt that if I started pointing to these to these either omissions or distortions in detail, that I would open up another avenue of thought about him, which would distract from the central significance of what he has achieved. I've hinted at it because I have said quite plainly that memory is a curious thing, and that many of the Holocaust survivors have remembered different things at different times. And I mean, I don't think that I've suppressed things, but I have simply not emphasized them as much as perhaps another biographer would have done. Though I have to say that the only other person who has made any attempt to write about his life was a book called The Wiesenthal Files, which is a book which appeared about 2 years before my book appeared, and whose author had originally gone to Wiesenthal simply to write about his relationship with Kreisky, and then expanded it to cover many of the Nazi war criminals that Wiesenthal had dealt with, and so on. And it turned into a semi-biography, but it was wholly uncritical of him, and simply, made him look even more heroic than I've done. So, but I really came to the conclusion that warts and all, and he's certainly not a perfect character, and has many, many shortcomings, but that he is sort of one of the 20th century's authentic heroes. In the sense that here was an individual who, by sheer force of character, managed to convey a crucially important message to the world. And I think because of that, one has to make certain concessions to the way, at least I felt I had to make certain concessions to the way that described his wartime activities. I don't think I've written anything genuinely false, but I have not pointed as much to the discrepancies as perhaps another person would have done.
Do you think that these discrepancies sort of feed into the camp of the deniers of the Holocaust, that it's something that they fasten on, ignoring the explanation that you've looked at, particularly memory, after so many years? And is the Holocaust denial linked with this?
Well, not so much the Holocaust denial, but the Wiesenthal denigrators are linked to it. I don't think it has anything to do with much less to do with Holocaust denial, because they've operated in quite different areas, really, and refer themselves to different events. But I think where it did matter is in the way in which the communists and later Kreisky, and again the World Jewish Congress have dealt with the Wiesenthal phenomenon. I think, and they've all of them, I leave out the World Jewish Congress, but certainly the communists and Kreisky focused on the sort of ambiguities surrounding his time in the camp in Lvov, and his relationship with the camp commandant there, why did he have a preferential, why did he have preferential treatment? And the inference has always been that he was in collusion with the Gestapo. I mean, that was what the communists tried to argue, and what Kreisky certainly said quite explicitly. And also, that is what these early Mossad reports on him, which I found in CIA files, suggested. So there were all these, and they all just focused on that. Nobody else has paid attention to any of the other discrepancies that I've mentioned. And certainly no one else has pointed to the sort of question of how long was he actually free between escaping from the Arnofsky camp and being recaptured. So it's really just, it's always been just this question of how, what really happened in that Yanovska camp. And I think there is a genuine distortion here, because it seems to me it is plausible, and I've talked to people I've talked to other survivors, that because the camp commandant who ended up being a friend, because they kept in touch after the war, had genuine use for, needed him. He was essentially, even though he was an SS officer, I'm not even sure if he was SS, but certainly he was not a Nazi Party member, but his main objective was to keep those railways repaired and to keep the railway repair yard going. And Wiesenthal was very useful to him in that, because he was trained, he could communicate, he had the language, and he knew how to design whatever had to be designed and planned in those railway yards. But I'm absolutely convinced that he never became linked himself to the Gestapo, or in any way acted as an informer against other camp inmates, or indeed against the underground. Quite the opposite. I think he used the information that he gained from his special place in that camp to help the underground. There's no other way that his wife would have been able to escape, because they helped his wife to escape and they looked after her. No way this could have happened if they had felt that in any way that he was betraying them. And it just doesn't make sense to me. But there was enough ambiguity in the just how did all this happen, that the communists could make use of it when they themselves are being attacked by him, that they countered with these rumors about him. And they went to great lengths to try and sort of falsely document some of this. I mean, I found his Stasi file. Well, I didn't find he got hold of his Stasi file in the end, and so I was able to look at that as well. But even though the Stasi tried to prove, and I think put up a sort of completely false record about him to prove that he was a collaborator, I don't think there was any genuine evidence ever that he was a collaborator. And it goes so much against his whole nature and character that I just dismiss all that as deliberate anti-Wiesenthal propaganda. The World Jewish Congress, which has been one of Wiesenthal's most outspoken critics for a great many years, focused far less on these allegations that he'd been a collaborator, though I'm sure from time to time even they have used that. And they focus much more on his activities after the war. And they forever are trying to suggest that the claims that he makes for what he has achieved are greatly exaggerated, if not altogether wrong. And the starting point for them always is Eichmann, and they always insist, just like Issa Harel does in Israel, and the two of them have worked together at various points, they always insist that Wiesenthal had absolutely nothing to do with the discovery of Eichmann, and that he has always falsely claimed glory for himself, which he doesn't deserve, and this just proves what a charlatan and what a liar he is. I've tried to reconstruct the whole Eichmann saga from beginning to end, and I'm totally convinced that Wiesenthal has actually, in this particular case, not made any claims that he can't substantiate, except with one or two things which I'll mention in a second. But I'm absolutely convinced that he kept alive the fact that... Sorry. I'm absolutely convinced that if it had not been for him, Eichmann would have been declared dead, and therefore the search for him would have stopped. He discovered, by chance, that his Eichmann's wife had applied for a certificate of death on his behalf, claiming that he had been killed in Prague at the end of the war. And if he hadn't been able to stop that, which he did, the whole Eichmann saga would have died there and then. He believes, and I think he's probably right, because this was during the beginning of the Cold War, when the Western Allies had certainly lost all interest in hunting for war criminals. They were much more concerned with the Cold War, and at a time when Israel itself also was far too preoccupied with establishing its existence and its independence, and was certainly not at that stage at all focusing on any of the war, of the mass murderers. And Wiesenthal, by chance, having started to look for war criminals, discovered that in Linz, where he was living at the time, in Upper Austria, that just a few houses down the road from where he was living, Eichmann had lived himself, and his family was still there. And through a series of coincidences, he established that Eichmann's wife was living in a place called Altaussee, which is also in Upper Austria, in Styria, in Steiermark, and which is a part of Austria that I know very well, and that she was hidden there, that her children were even going to school in the local school, and he was absolutely convinced that Eichmann sooner or later would not only try to get in touch with her, but would actually try to see her. And so, anyway, I describe all this in my book, but through a whole sort of series of ruses and so on, he certainly confirmed that she was there, that the children were there, that he was in contact with her, but through a mistaken identity, because he had a brother who Wiesenthal discovered far later was almost identical in looks, when they thought that he was coming to see her, when in fact it was that Eichmann was in touch, when in fact it was the brother. But there were sort of various trysts at night when they thought they were going to catch the Eichmann and so on. But then after a while, he realized, I think, that Eichmann was not in Austria, and it was no longer in Austria. But then again, but he kept on looking and looking and couldn't figure out where Eichmann had got to. He thought by then that he had probably slipped out from Italy with the help of the Vatican, which is one reason Wiesenthal realized quite early on that in the Vatican there had been senior prelates who had helped a whole lot of war criminals to escape to South America. Anyhow, he's a stamp collector. That's the only hobby that Wiesenthal appears to have. And he met a stamp collector in Austria who by chance said he just had such an interesting stamp on a postcard from Argentina, and on the card was a message from the friends who had sent the thing, saying, you know, it's how odd it was, but they had just been in a cafe and they'd happened to see that Eichmann was there. And that is how he realized that Eichmann was in South America. And that was when the whole dispute with the World Jewish Congress began, because he then set out in great detail all that he had, all the work that he'd done in trying to find Eichmann, and that he now felt reasonably certain that Eichmann was in fact in South America, in Argentina. And he gave this letter to the then Israeli consul in Vienna, but asked him to pass the whole correspondence on to the head of the World Jewish Congress. And he then got back a letter from a rabbi in New York, to whom this correspondence had been passed, with some really sort of questions which suggested that he hadn't even read what Wiesenthal had written. And the long and the short of it was that the World Jewish Congress, because he had written to the World Jewish Congress and said, I lack the means to carry on with this search, I don't have the money to go to South America, up to you. And they interpreted this letter apparently as an appeal for money, and they were not interested. And so they passed it on to this one rabbi in New York to handle. Themselves had no interest whatsoever in taking up the cudgels for Eichmann. And as I said, in later life, they denied that they'd even had this correspondence. Now, my feeling is, and it's back to some extent, there's one member of the World Jewish Congress who now lives in Geneva who knew Wiesenthal in those very early days in the camps after the war, when he was working amongst displaced people, trying to get them to testify as much as they could about the Holocaust, because he realized once these people had dispersed, he would never be able to get hold of their testimony anymore. And during that period, he certainly had contact with the World Jewish Congress, which was also operating in those camps, and with this particular person. And they seem to have had a great personality clash. Wiesenthal was obviously always very much an egomaniac and difficult to work with, and I think he had then advised. This man had then later advised the World Jewish Congress that Wiesenthal was an impossible person to deal with. So that this all goes back, as far as I can tell, to these very early experiences in the camps. This particular person, when I asked to meet him and talk to him about this, he refused. Even though I have friends in Geneva who know him very well and who tried to speak to him, and said, no, I won't speak to him. And that was it. He just did not want to reopen this. But I'm convinced that this whole reluctance to have anything to do with Wiesenthal goes back to that early post-war period. But from then on, Eichmann was eventually captured because one of the prosecutors in Germany accidentally discovered the actual whereabouts of Eichmann, because Wiesenthal never he knew he was in Argentina, but he never had an address. He simply said that now it was time for other people with more means at their disposal to look for him there. And then, this was several years later, they finally did find him. And then the Mossad captured him and took him back to Israel, and he was tried. Wiesenthal was in Israel during the trial, and was very much feted, because he gave press conferences, and he certainly made known that he'd kept the flame alive when no one else had the slightest interest in doing so. And he then wrote a book called I have to look up the title of the book. Yes, he then wrote a book called I Found Eichmann. He didn't say I captured Eichmann, and he made quite clear in that book that he had not been involved in the actual search for him in Argentina or in his capture. And yet, Issa Harel, who was the head of the Mossad at that point, and the World Jewish Congress have always persisted in saying that he claimed that he captured Eichmann, that he was actually, really, that he found him at the time of his arrest. And the book gained Wiesenthal worldwide fame. It was published in several languages. It had a very wide readership. It certainly earned him some of the money that he needed to establish himself in Vienna, because it was only then that he moved to Vienna and opened his little documentation center. But I have, I've said this earlier on already, but the more I thought about the way in which the World Jewish Congress handled that, the shabbier I found the whole treatment of Wiesenthal, and wholly unjustified, except in terms of blind prejudice and also self-aggrandizement. I have to say that Wiesenthal, for his part, spent a great deal of time rubbishing the World Jewish Congress to me. He's deeply opposed to them, and this, of course, then I come to Waldheim in a second. But he always made the point to me, and makes the same point to other people, that even though it has this title, World Jewish Congress, this is primarily an American organization and does not represent world Jewry, even though they would like the world to think that it does. And by the same token, I think he hasn't taken such a vocal stand in recent years, but he certainly feels that it is absolutely wrong that the World Jewish Congress has been accepted so widely as one of the principal spokesorganization with respect to the financial claims that are being made against Switzerland, against Germany, and against Austria, that they should have been the key negotiators trying to negotiate on behalf of worldwide Jewry. I share his view. I think it is totally wrong, because they don't represent more than themselves and their membership, and that membership does not extend very widely outside the United States. But anyway, that's a hobby horse of mine, perhaps. I won't expand on that too much. But I just wanted to add to the confrontation between Wiesenthal and the World Jewish Congress over Eichmann, the more recent and the culminating confrontation between those two really occurred over Kurt Waldheim. The World Jewish Congress, which led the campaign against Kurt Waldheim when he stood for election as president of Austria, have claimed that Wiesenthal has become a sort of apologist for Waldheim, and that Wiesenthal, far from doing his usual kind of investigation to establish whether someone really was whether there was sufficient evidence against the person to put him to arrest him and put him in the dock, in the case of Waldheim, he just went on hearsay and did no real work, and in a way colluded with Waldheim. The collaborator's label being pinned on him with respect to Waldheim, and all because Wiesenthal said almost from the outset that Waldheim had clearly lied about his wartime record, and he confirmed, he got together the evidence which confirmed Waldheim's wartime presence in Yugoslavia and his staff job on the staff of General Löhr, who was in charge of the deportations and the pogroms and the massacres there, but that he had just been a junior lieutenant, and that he could not be accused of having actually been one of the people who took the decisions or indeed even organized the deportations, and that as a liar, he did not deserve to be president and should not be president. But you couldn't accuse him of being a war criminal. And the World Jewish Congress insisted that this just demonstrated that he had lent himself to pressure, that he'd given way to pressures from Waldheim or whoever, and that he was just being dishonest and did not deserve the reputation that he had gained for himself. And this was particularly the invective that the World Jewish Congress people used against him really got more and more vicious. And they at one point tried to make him answer a questionnaire that questions his credentials with respect to sort of almost everything. Wiesenthal believes that they blocked his nomination for the Nobel Peace Prize. The whole thing just got worse and worse and worse. And there's a huge amount of bitterness on his side. And on the side of the World Jewish Congress, a sense of righteous indignation that anybody could possibly question their accuracy or their wisdom in what they did with respect to Waldheim. Kurt Waldheim himself tried to convince me, because I have to say I also interviewed him for the Wiesenthal book, he just had memory lapses, which were perfectly understandable, blah, 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 but also sort of tried to get Wiesenthal to make some kind of a gesture of friendship towards him, but Wiesenthal at this point back refuses to have anything to do with him and does not acknowledge him. But it's an unhappy episode, which in the end, curiously enough, helped to finally to raise Wiesenthal's standing in Austria, because the Austrians interpreted his stand against the World Jewish Congress and his stand against having their president labeled a war criminal as a sign, as a patriotic gesture, so to speak. And it is from the mid-1980s onwards when the Waldheim crisis occurred, that Wiesenthal has become a kind of icon to the Austrians, and that his rehabilitation has been one important aspect of Austria's efforts to show that it is coming to terms with its history and recognizes its responsibilities for what happened during the war, and so on and so forth. So Wiesenthal has become sort of part of the whole machinery of rehabilitation.